time to welcome to the show my first guest of this evening. She is from the University of Kent School of Psychology. She is Associate Editor of Social Psychology, and she is the Associate Editor of the European Journal of Social Psychology. Hello, Karen Douglas, Dr. Karen Douglas. Welcome to the Tony Legend Show.
Hello, thank you.
Now, nice to have you join us on the show. You're the first guest of the second season of the Tony Legend Show, so we appreciate you coming on and appreciate you getting involved in the show tonight. Okay, can you hear us all right, yeah?
Yep, I can, yeah.
All right, now this week you were in Manchester here giving a speech at the Skeptics Society. How did you feel that went?
I thought it was fantastic, actually. I think that everybody was very welcoming. I really enjoyed the experience. I've never given a talk in a pub before. Very used to giving lectures and talking in academic settings, but I found this a really, really good experience and got fantastic questions, and everybody was very kind.
And tell us a little bit about the University of Kent School of Psychology, and tell us about some of the various research that you and your colleagues study.
Well, quite varied, actually. We have about, 30 members of academic staff, all of whom do different kinds of research. We tend to split ourselves up into different categories of research, so I call myself a social psychologist, and people like me study things like prejudice and social inequality, persuasion, social influence, personality, how people respond to justice in society and those sorts of things. But there's other psychologists in the department as well who study cognition, so kind of like vision and visual perception, memory and emotions and that sort of thing. We also have some developmental psychologists, so they focus on how children develop in terms of the way they think, as they get older, how language develops, and also things like how children achieve and how they're motivated to achieve in educational settings. And we have some forensic psychologists on our staff as well, and they're interested in things like sexual harassment and child sex offending and prison behaviour and that sort of thing as well. So we're quite a varied department, I suppose, of different areas of research.
And you began studying the psychology of conspiracy theories. What drew you, first of all, to this subject?
I guess just a personal interest, really, in persuasion in general. Since I was a PhD student, and even earlier than that, I was always kind of interested in how the media has such an impact on the way we think about things, our attitudes, and also the way that we behave. So I've kind of had a long-standing interest in how people are influenced by the media and how they respond to the media. And my PhD was actually in internet behaviour, so how people respond to particular people when they're speaking online, in online settings. So, and kind of bringing in as well an interest in generally why people believe things that most people might consider to be out of the ordinary, I suppose drawing all those things together, it seemed natural to take a look at conspiracy theories because they're so pervasive, so popular. And, that's kind of where I came from.
You mentioned there you studied how people respond to the media, and I presume that's how they respond to news stories and stuff. What did you find studying that?
Well, I'm kind of interested in how people think about advertising and how advertising influences people's behaviour. And people in general have this tendency to assume that the media influences other people, but it doesn't necessarily influence themselves. So most people are going to be wrong about that because the media does influence people, otherwise there would be no point in having it there. So advertising exists to get people to buy products and that sort of thing. So people are slightly, incorrect, I suppose, when they assume that things don't influence them. So lately I've become interested in why people have this idea that others are more influenced than themselves, why people see themselves as relatively invulnerable. And I kind of find that people have these naive theories about how advertising works, and that they think that other people are less mindful than themselves. They think that people think less and process information less than themselves. So they think that they themselves are invulnerable, but others are quite vulnerable to the influence of the media. So that's the kind of thing that I'm finding in that area of research.
All right, now let's get to the psychology of conspiracy theories. What were your preconceptions on the subject when you started the research? Had you researched any 9/11 information, or delved into the New World Order, or looked into any of these, what you would call a conspiracy theory?
To be honest, no, I didn't really at all. When I started researching conspiracy theories, I saw them really quite naively, I suppose. It's just another source of social influence. This is a piece of information or an additional kind of source of information that people might not consider but might necessarily have an influence on how you think about a particular significant event of social or political kind of importance. So I didn't really have any preconceived ideas about conspiracy theories. I'd from a social psychological perspective, I'd read about some of the motivations that people might have to believe in conspiracy theories, but I didn't have very much idea at all about how influential they were, so whether they actually did influence people's attitudes about these significant social events. And also I didn't know anything at all, and I didn't really go in with any preconceived ideas about the psychological processes that are involved in believing in conspiracy theories. So I kind of just stumbled into this area. I didn't really have any ideas about it before I began, other than drawing on my previous experience in research on social influence and that sort of thing.
Okay. So you studied the psychology of these conspiracy theories. Tell us about your research techniques and tests.
Okay. Well, I'm a social psychologist. So in this type of research, we normally use questionnaires to assess people's attitudes in these particular topics. So you ask people questions or present them with statements about particular conspiracy theories, and you get them to rate, like on a scale from about 1 to 7 or something like that, how much they agree or disagree with these particular statements. So that's kind of the methodology that we tend to use to examine how much people endorse conspiracy theories. That's the type of thing that we do.
Cool. And tell us about some of the results that you found when you started studying this.
Okay. Well, in general, I kind of first started out from this social influence perspective, kind of wondering and hypothesizing about how influential conspiracy theories might actually be on people's attitudes. So we think about advertisements influencing what people think and what they do about particular products. So I asked the question, do conspiracy theories, or these alternative explanations that go beyond mainstream explanations for significant world events, do they actually influence what people think? And I found that conspiracy theories, being exposed to conspiracy theories, actually influences people's attitudes about specific significant events without people necessarily knowing that they're influenced. And we tested this specifically on conspiracy theories surrounding the death of Princess Diana. And we found that exposing people to conspiracy theories that perhaps they might, some of them may have known about them before, some of them may not have heard about them before, but reading about these specific conspiracy theories made people's attitudes change towards the event, but they weren't actually aware that their attitudes had changed, because we had a comparison group that hadn't read any of these conspiracy theories, and comparing to those, we found that the treatment group or the experimental group had changed their attitudes quite a lot, but they didn't actually acknowledge that their attitudes had changed. So that was the first kind of area that we examined. And since then, we've been getting more into some of the psychological processes that might be involved in determining whether or not a person believes in conspiracy theories or not. And we find that one reason why people may believe in conspiracy theories is because they're uncertain about a particular event. They don't really know very much about what has happened, and yet if it's a significant societal event or a significant political event that, you know, is quite a big thing and it requires an explanation, people need to find an explanation. But if they don't have a lot of information about what happened, then they don't have any frame of reference on really to kind of make any judgments. So the only frame of reference they really have is to look within themselves and ask themselves, well, is this conspiracy theory a plausible explanation? And to do that, to some extent, people must look within themselves and think, well, you know, if I was in that situation myself, is that something that I would have done? So if I was in the position of, you know, Prince Philip, would I have kind of ordered some kind of assassination attempt on Princess Diana? And we find that people who do think that if they were in the position themselves are also likely to endorse conspiracy theories. So we interpret this as a kind of a process of people projecting their own personal tendencies onto others, or these would-be conspirators, in situations where they don't really have very much control, or they don't really have very much knowledge about what has actually gone on. They're uncertain, so they use themselves as a frame of reference. And that's where we're kind of at the moment, amongst various other things that are ongoing.
But do you think it could be dangerous to lump all these so-called theories in together as one single unit, as the conspiracy theory unit? Do you not think that possibly Iraq is very different to the fact that people might talk about aliens? Do you not think that you should distinguish between various aspects of what is lumped as? Do you think it's dangerous to just pigeonhole it as conspiracy theories? Anybody who questions anything is a conspiracy theorist?
Well, that's certainly not what we're doing. We're not labelling people as conspiracy theorists. And we're totally not assuming that beliefs in conspiracy theories are a negative thing. They're simply interesting from a psychological perspective because they go beyond a mainstream explanation. So we're interested in why people believe these explanations or kind of endorse these explanations that are different to what the mainstream explanation is. So they're anomalous in that way, but we're not saying that they're good or bad, and we're not saying that people are crazy or otherwise for believing in them. And to be honest, I think that conspiracy theories do have, you know, it's a pejorative term. You think of conspiracy theories, you think automatically of negative things, but it of course may be the case that some conspiracy theories are quite useful to people, and they cause people to question authority and that sort of thing. So we're not saying that they're all negative at all, and we're not labelling people as conspiracy theorists. And of course, I think that many conspiracy theories are different. They're not all about the same event, for a start. Some of them are quite sinister and malevolent, and others are less so. Others are more about protection, I guess. So I think, yes, of course, there is a danger of putting them all together. In terms of our research, however, we have focused on a specific kind of conspiracy theory, more your sinister governmental conspiracy theory. So these items tend to hang together quite well in a scientific and psychological scale. But of course, we're only scratching the surface in terms of all these different types of conspiracy theories, and I think that the picture is much more complex than we can paint in a couple of studies, I think.
Cool. And why do you think that conspiracy theories are becoming so prominent, especially on the internet?
Well, the internet, it's an amazing way for people to share information. And you know, back in the olden days, we just didn't have that system of being able to share information and share attitudes and share beliefs. So we are enabled now to share a vast amount of information with a vast array of different people. So it's just become so much easier to get information across and to get information if you want to get it. It also means that, you know, if you just surfing the internet, you're exposed to a lot of different information, you're exposed to many different arguments. If you go on the internet and you think, well, you know, I want to find out about the death of Princess Diana, if you read a newspaper, you might read one or two different explanations. If you go on the internet, you can read hundreds of different explanations. So people are exposed to a lot more information. And the internet is also amazing because it allows people to connect with others who share their views. So both individuals and groups of people who are like-minded. So you might share a particular belief. You find people who think the same way as you, and that is a way of reinforcing your ideas and also gaining solidarity for the opinions that you have, and validation. So if you do hold views that are slightly off the mainstream, you go on the internet, you can find other people who think the same things as you, which strengthens your views, and it's like any kind of social support, I suppose. You get reinforcement for your views. So I think that all of those factors, if you put them together, mean that the internet becomes a very, very powerful way of sharing information and a very, very easy way to share conspiracy theories.
Okay, our guest this hour is Karen Douglas, Dr. Karen Douglas from the University of Kent. And if you want to get in touch with us here in studio by MSN, is probably the best way to get in touch in real time. Add us and get in touch, studio@manchesterradioonline.com. Now, Dr. Karen Douglas, we are joined in studio by Steve James, and he's got some questions from listeners there. Do you want to ask them, Steve?
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of questions coming in already this evening for you, Karen. First one is, having researched the theories, do you find, she's putting you on the spot a little bit, this one, do you find any truth in them?
Oh, do you know, that's totally not for me to say, and I kind of, whenever I'm asked this question, I do tend to avoid answering it, honestly, because that's not what my research is about. I'm not about saying whether or not these theories are true or false. I find reading about these theories extremely interesting and extremely thought-provoking, but it isn't my place to say whether or not they're true or false. I'm simply interested in why, from a psychological perspective, people believe in conspiracy theories. So I'm sorry to kind of deflect that one, but I'm going to have to.
No problem. Any more there, Steve?
Well, again, it was a one on the similar lines, basically saying, obviously, with regards to the official stories put out by the media. I know I've had this on numerous occasions, and people have said to me, the only conspiracy is the official story. And again, the question was coming in there, do you see any... I know you're not going to answer this one either, Karen, but obviously with regards to the conspiracy in the official media stories, but again, I'm presuming it's along the same lines as...
Yeah, it's along the same lines. Again, it's not really what our research is about. I'm not going to say whether or not I think these theories are true or false, and you know, there's so many different ones, and many of which I just don't know anything about, so I can't possibly comment. But we're really about trying to explain the psychological processes rather than, you know, find support or contradiction to the theories themselves. I'm actually working with a PhD student at the moment called Mike Wood, and he's really interested in kind of the differences between mainstream explanations and conspiracy explanations. So again, he's not really looking at whether or not these things are true or false, but looking at the differences between the two different types of explanations. And you find that mainstream explanations, they tend to be more plausible the more detailed they are, but conspiracy theory explanations tend to be more plausible the simpler they are, especially if people are just asking questions. So again, he's not really working on the idea of whether or not these things are true or false, but more about the contrast between the different types of explanations that are out there, and they are different.
Okay,
so I hope that helps.
Dr. Karen Douglas, thank you very much for joining us this evening. I'm sure the listeners are going to have a bit to say later on as we present this debate from now until 10 o'clock, but we appreciate your input tonight and thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, there she goes, folks, Dr. Karen Douglas from the University of Kent, and we do want to hear from you tonight. Please let us know what your thoughts are on this. Steve, what's your thoughts first and foremost?
Well, I understand that she doesn't, obviously Karen doesn't want to be put on the spot there, but I mean, obviously, I think having been introduced to these theories, if you want to call them conspiracy theories, I tend to work off facts, and I always obviously try and get the facts out of any information. So, you know, obviously I can appreciate her response there with regards to the research is purely to assess the psychological effect the conspiracy theories have. But yeah, you know, what can I say? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the information, if I was looking at it and I was studying it, I would have to have an opinion on it myself.
But. And Neil has got in touch and he says, well, it's a bit late now because we've just let the doctor go, but he says, how can you investigate psychological processes without considering the actual information people are looking at and saying if there is any valid information? Thank you very much for getting in touch, Neil, and that's probably the summary of where we're at here in the studio. It's obviously very good that people is investigating this. It's good that it's hitting the radar of the senior lecturers and the professors and the doctors out there. And it's also very good to hear that they're rising and more people are believing these so-called conspiracy theories. Well, the bottom line is that people need to investigate these things themselves, make their own minds up, and not be pigeonholed by or labelled as a conspiracy theorist, because I think it is probably a derogatory term. We're going to get back into a bit of music right now. This is very, very, very big tune, very deep. It's by Smooth, and the track's called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. You're listening to The Tony Legend Show. This is ManchesterRadioOnline.com. You're listening to The Tony Legend Show, back on air once again. That was Smooth, and The Revolution Will Be Televised. All right, right now we've got on the phone a responder to our first guest of tonight. Neil, welcome to The Tony Legend Show.
Thank you very much, Tony.
How you doing?
I'm not too bad, thanks, you?
I'm sweet, mate. Now, you were actually at the speech given in Manchester this week by Dr. Karen Douglas. Tell us how you found that.
Well, as I say, I attended Karen's lecture for Greater Manchester Skeptics. Admittedly, it was 30 minutes late. And although she did state afterwards that she didn't intend to label people conspiracy theorists, she did appear to be saying that a study showed that conspiracy theorists tend to have undesirable traits, for example, Machiavellian in nature. Now, not being a social psychologist, I didn't realise what she was saying, but I now know that it means a person's tendency to deceive and manipulate other people for their personal gain. I can assure her that there is no personal gain in questioning the events of 9/11 or 7/7. Quite to the contrary, you tend to find that if people aren't really interested in hearing about what really happened on 9/11, very soon they'll like to talk about the X Factor or what happened in Coronation Street. But if you mention 9/11 on more than one occasion a week, you'll probably get accused of bringing up 9/11 all the time, you know. I've had the same thing with members of my family when I've been trying to talk to them about things. So, yeah, I mean, people have valid questions about the terrorist attacks of 9/11 and 7/7. There is valid questions. The families of some of the 9/11 victims fought for an investigation into the attacks, an investigation that President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney didn't even want. When they finally did agree to testify, it was behind closed doors. They insisted on testifying together, obviously, in each other's company. And finally, most importantly, they would only testify off the record. As far as I know, none of their testimony is actually included in the 9/11 Commission report. Just some of the things that a social psychologist really should look at. I know Karen said we didn't want to look at the actual information, we just wanted to look at the psychology. For me, the two things go hand in hand. You can't understand the psychology of a person or their possible motivations unless you're prepared to take a look at the information that they've looked at, you know? It just seems a real intellectual get-out card to me, saying, yeah, we're going to decide that certain people may belong in a certain group, but we're not going to look at any of the reasons why. Some of the information to me is considered as Pakistani intelligence agency, the ISI, allegedly wired 100,000 to the lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta, just prior to September 11th. Reportedly through the ISI, Omar Shahid Sheikh, who I think he was later arrested for the murder of that reporter, Daniel Pearl. He was investigating ISI connections as well. That was ignored by the 9/11 Commission investigation, and The guy who ran the probe, Bob Graham and Paul Tagossa, were meeting with the ISI chief, Mahmoud Ahmed, weren't they, on Capitol Hill, the morning of 9/11. That was reported in the mainstream media. Another thing Karen needs to consider is multiple war games are taking place on 9/11. You know, simulations including multiple hijacked aircraft with planes being flown into buildings. False radar blips were inserted to simulate real aircraft. That caused a lot of confusion, and, you know, I think a lot of us have heard the recording where there's an FAA or NORAD official who actually asks, is this real world or exercise? So he's obviously really confused. Then we've got odd anomalies in the official story. We've got a hijacker passport found on the sidewalk, reportedly found by a member of the public handing it in to a member of the FBI. And yet, we're told in the 9/11 Commission report that neither of the flight recorders from the World Trade Center attack were ever found. I mean, call me a conspiracy theorist, but I wouldn't expect a passport to manage to find its way out of the aircraft and survive. You know, a passport belonging to one of the hijackers, when the flight recorders just seem to vanish into thin air. You know, there's so many questions. It's actually incredible. And the reason why we're getting conspiracy theories is because the mainstream media are refusing to look at the information and are refusing to question it.
Of course. And do you think that the word conspiracy theorist is a modern term for using common sense?
It is, yeah. More and more now, I've seen it. I think there's a journalist called Nick Cohen. He used the word conspiracy theorist and conspiracy theories in a number of articles. And one article he wrote, he actually managed to use the word Holocaust denial, and then he used the phrase climate change denial, and then he used the phrase 9/11 denial. I mean, it was such a blatant attempt to link all the three things together, you know. So, oh, if you've got any genuine questions about 9/11, you're obviously questioning the Holocaust. If you don't accept climate change and all its claims and all its glory, then you're a climate change denialist. It just comes across to me as petty establishment name-calling, and they know they can't win the debate head-on by debating the evidence. So this Karen Douglas, to me, of all respect to her, she appears to be debating the debater instead of debating the evidence.
I agree. Neil, we've got so much to get through on the show. We really appreciate your input, and we hope you keep listening and stay in touch and get in touch as often as you want. Feel free.
Okay, I'll keep listening. I'll let some of your callers have a go.
All right, no worries. Thank you very much, Neil.
Bye.
Okay, folks, we have got our next guest lined up, and we'll be going to him in a couple of minutes, right? Here's the radio online on a Sunday night. This is the Tony Legend Show. That was Gentleman, Leave Us Alone, total political reggae anthem there. All right, time for our next caller. He is a researcher, software engineer, and from the website checktheevidence.com, Andrew Johnson. Welcome back to the Tony Legend Show.
Thanks very much for inviting me on.
No problem. Great to have you here. Now, you listened to our interview with Dr. Karen Douglas there. First impressions, please.
Yeah, well, I think Neil did a pretty good job of describing the overall thrust of what you said in terms of, I like the phrase that he used, you know, she was debating the debater rather than debating the evidence. You know, and I made a few notes as I was going along, and I think the main thing which came out of it for me, which is what comes out of it from the psychological perspective, is belief. Now, she talked a lot about belief and believing whether a theory was true or not. You know, she talked about going onto the internet and finding people who share your belief. But the point is that it's not really conspiracy theory, as you know, you've said and Neil has said. It's to do with evidence. So, you know, that's why my website is called Check the Evidence. And indeed, why Karen Douglas, you know, did the study in the way that she did, she collected evidence to support her conclusions. Now, this is what we have to do in terms of 9/11, and psychology comes into it in the mainstream media in the way they perpetrated the crime. The people knew that you know, people out there were going to need answers. So, for example, 45 seconds after the, I think, the second impact of this supposed plane, which wasn't a plane, so anybody who thinks that planes are involved in 9/11 has been sucked in by the alternative media, which has given them another set of false answers over and above what the mainstream media have given
them. Worms.
So that's another thing that Neil needs to look into and revisit, because court cases have been submitted based on this evidence. So you give people an answer, and then they stop thinking about it. So in other words, The regular people want to know what happened on 9/11. Oh, Osama bin Laden did it. You know, he's a Muslim. That's, you know, basically not a Christian religion, so he's obviously a foreigner, so he must be a bad guy. He did it. That fulfills my answer. You get the people who think about it a bit more. Why did those towers come down? You know, why did those, how were those planes hijacked? And then they'll say, oh, well, thermite was used to destroy the towers. It wasn't Osama bin Laden, and the planes were remotely controlled by the US government. So you give the conspiracy theorists, if you want to call them that, their alternative answer, and then they believe that, and that's all those people dealt with. So you have to keep looking at the evidence. If you want to establish the truth about something, if you want to establish why the sky is blue, if you want to establish why night follows day, you have to look at the evidence. Now, I don't believe that night follows day. I know that night follows day because I've studied the evidence. In other words, I go out of my house and I look up at the sky and I see it goes dark. So, again, you look at the World Trade Center towers again on all the videos and the photographs. Did they turn to dust, or did they collapse, or did they burn down? The official story says they burned down. The other story says that they were changed into molten metal, and that, of course, is not true. They actually turned to dust. And when you actually study that evidence in detail, you know, you have to come to a different conclusion. And I think, you know, Karen Douglas would do very well to go and look at the court cases which have been filed by Dr. Judy Wood and Dr. Morgan Mellors themselves, PhDs. You can't file court cases based on belief. You have to have evidence. So, again, it comes back to the evidence. So I would also just like to point out to Karen Douglas something that President Eisenhower said, because I think this applies very much to the academic environment. And this comes from Eisenhower's speech in 1961. And he said, today, the solitary inventor tinkering in his shop has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the Free University, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research, partly because of the huge cost involved. A government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. And for every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. So Eisenhower saw the writing on the wall, and it's this sort of research which is then used to generate government policy, and it is also used, as she said, in advertising to herd people's thinking into a particular mindset, which is essentially all about believing what somebody says and not actually going and checking enough of things for yourself.
All right, getting to the actual the term that has been used here, conspiracy theory. Do you think it's obviously quite a derogatory term, or at least it has negative connotations. Do you think it's dangerous to lump these all in together and just call Iraq, aliens, and 9/11 conspiracy theories?
Well, it is, and I think, you know, absolutely it is. And I think some of the things, for example, that were quoted about 9/11, you know, how do we know that Mohammed Asif's passport was found on the pavement? That's just a posting on the internet, you know, so we don't know if that's true or not. So, and that applies to a lot of these things. How much can we really honestly say is true? And so, you know, how much is a theory and how much is based on evidence? It comes back to that. And it, yes, it is a derogatory term. The phrase conspiracy theory doesn't really mean a group, it doesn't really mean these days the idea that some group of people might conspire to do something and then hide what they actually did. It is more used, as I think Neil brought up in the discussion he did, that it's used to label people with a certain type of behaviour. It's got nothing to do with evidence. Oh, that person, you know, they must be a bit stupid, or they must be a bit gullible because they believe these conspiracy theories, but it's actually nothing to do with theories. It's to do with evidence. So when you get that vocabulary into people's minds again by repetition in the media, you know. And the other thing is that she mentioned Princess Diana, which is very interesting because when I first spoke to one of my sister's friends, this was about 3 years ago, and I told her what I'd been researching into because it came up in general conversation. I said, oh, I've been researching into 9/11 and what actually happened. And the first thing she said was, oh, I think Diana was murdered. So it's interesting the way that people associate these things, and she went straight from one thing, which I wasn't even bringing up, to the Diana thing, because that had received such a lot of media attention. So again, that in and of itself shows the psychology of of how people's minds work. And I think people doing psychological studies, they tend to sort of lump all that thinking together. And the problem is, as I see it, is that when you reach these new conclusions, which you reach by studying the evidence, it changes your whole worldview completely. I mean, my worldview has changed completely in the last 7 years, and I now realise that much of the systems which are in place and which we live by are basically illusions, and we've been, conned into this situation, being told to believe certain things, and through that, in that process, we've been manipulated. So I think the psychologists really ought to look into this sort of way of things. And in fact, we know that psychologists look into this sort of things, and you've just got to look at things like MKUltra, and those disclosed projects, because they're all about psychology, and they use the psychology for mind control. So, you've got all this evidence out there to be examined and studied, and as Karen said, with access given by the internet, it's not just a question of sharing your views, it's a question of doing accelerated research. In other words, if you want to find 100 papers about a certain subject, you can find them in 2 seconds on the internet. If you wanted to do the same thing in a library 10 years ago, it would have taken you a day. So in other words, you can do a day's worth of research in 10 seconds now. So that's the power of the internet. And you can cross-reference things much more quickly. Quite often you can establish the truth or falsity of many things very quickly. So it's this sort of process which I think has lifted a number of people's consciousness onto a new level. And they can, for those that can do it, they can adapt and assimilate information very, very quickly, and thereby sort of move the state of human knowledge forwards much more quickly. But the problem is that the old system of thinking, which involves peer review and having to fit into certain guidelines, that is really now outmoded. So, certainly, I work within a university, admittedly in a part-time capacity. There is no way that I can discuss some of the things that I know with some people in the university that I know, because they just wouldn't be able to keep up with it. So this is a whole area of psychology which I think needs to be studied in terms of this accelerated assimilation and availability of information and what it actually means for the state of human consciousness.
Moving on, obviously you've got the website, checktheevidence.com. One of the stories on there is about chemtrails. Tell us your take on chemtrails, changing subjects.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, chemtrails, that's another thing. You go outside, look at the sky, observe it over a few days, and see what comes up. Chemtrails, I started studying them probably in about 2005, primarily because of these grid patterns that were appearing in the sky. And I found that very difficult to accept that we could have these planes crossing at right angles, within the time they needed to do this to actually make a grid. So it appears that somebody is putting something into the sky, not every day, it doesn't seem to follow a regular pattern I've been able to establish, but on certain days we're seeing these trails persisting for long periods. Other days we don't see any trails at all. People, again, we've got all these various internet sites which claim various things, only some of which I think can be established with any truth. I've tried to put together a presentation about this where I've covered both the information and the disinformation that's been put out about chemtrails. Basic problem is if you have a plane travelling at above about 28,000 feet, your contrail should only last for a couple of minutes. If you look at studies done by the Institute of Atmospheric Physics, for example, they will claim that under certain conditions the trails can last for many, many minutes. But they don't really give you a specific set of conditions. Like they don't say, well, if you look at this sort of day, with the wind prevailing in this direction and this sort of temperature, and you have this sort of air traffic, then the trail will persist for this length of time. Nowhere have I seen a prescriptive description of how long a trail should last based on any prevailing conditions, or indeed based on any type of engine of an aircraft, the fuel that it uses, or anything like that. So you'll hear various studies proclaiming that contrails can last a certain amount of time, but they don't actually prove this with any hard evidence. They only give you sort of generic examples. What I've been doing in the last, well, it's almost a year now actually, the last 9 months, is I've been doing an air traffic survey, because I've got a unit, it's called the AirNav Radar Box. You can get these things off eBay, they're not cheap. And I've been using this to track the aircraft that come over my house, but I've actually found that only about 20% of the aircraft that this box picks up broadcast their position. In other words, the aircraft use this signalling system called ADS-B, and I believe now there's an iPhone application which can pick these things up as well. Somebody told me that the other day. And the box that I've got, it will pick up and decode this signal, log onto the internet, look up the plane, it'll give you a picture of the exact plane that's going over your house, it'll give you its speed, its destination, its source airport, the airline, and various other bits of information. But it will only give that information for about 20% of the flights that it picks up. In other words, there are other aircraft broadcasting an ADS-B signal, but all that they're broadcasting is their altitude only, not their position. So I only know that these aircraft are within a range of 120 miles, I think is about the range I've got, where I've got the aerial at the moment. So I've been trying to actually tabulate, the number of planes coming over my house in an hour, and comparing this on days that we see lots of trails and on days where there are no trails. And I'm still trying to process all these results, because each day, this box, if I leave it running for about 12 hours, the box will generate about 800,000 records. So you can imagine that if you run it for 10 days, you've got 8 million records to go through. So, of course, you have to do this with a program. But looking at what the data that I've got on this so far, there doesn't seem to be any real difference between the level of air traffic on the days where there's lots of trails and on the days where there are virtually no trails in the sky. So this immediately presents us with an anomaly, and I appear to be able to sort of say, well, if you're telling me this is just due to increased air traffic on those days, then that's not what the box is telling me. The box is telling me the air traffic level is basically the same. So these sorts of things we can start to study a bit more. Various other things that people talk about, for instance, they talk about barium being put in the fuel, or put into the spray, essentially, aluminium. I've read reports about this. I'm struggling with this actually going into the fuel, because if you put in additives in the fuel, then you're going to affect the engine performance, and you're going to get residue building up on the engines and this sort of thing. Some people think there are separate spraying nozzles attached. I haven't seen any good pictures of these that I can verify. One thing I have picked up with the box is I got two EasyJet flights going over my house. The box showed me that they were both EasyJet flights. They were both at about 33,000 feet. Both UK domestic flights. Both exactly the same type of aircraft, travelling very nearly the same speed. Same day, an hour apart. One left a big long trail, which I photographed and did a short video of, and the other one didn't. So I have two EasyJets, one leaving a big long trail and one not. I have not been able to get an explanation for this yet. I wrote to EasyJet. They didn't reply to my letter and DVD that I sent them, so I sent them an email a few weeks later, and they basically said, we cannot answer your operational query. I presume because they think I'm a terrorist, because that's what the assumption is always these days. So when you want to get evidence and get explanations, you can't get them, because you'll have some issue like, it's on a need-to-know basis, or you might be a terrorist, so we're not going to tell you, or it's we're not going to tell you because it would not have a commercial advantage in this area, blah blah blah, keep your nose out, accept the answers that you're given and shut up. So it's that sort of mentality which I think there needs to be a psychological study done of why authority is preventing us from accessing information which we would like to get, get, basically.
All right, just let me stop you there for a sec, Andrew. Neil says, chemtrails, the phrase sounds like lunacy, however, substitute the phrase chemtrails with geoengineering and you can find government papers discussing its use, effects and implications. And also Steve with me in studio will have something to add. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was going to say it's going to be one of the more difficult ones to get evidence and prove, I think, isn't it, the old chemtrail thing, Andrew? But I mean, he mentioned barium. I know I was looking at something to do with barium the other day. He was saying it, one of the main things it does is suppresses the immune system. So again, there could be a link between that and the sort of the old swine flu vaccinations and everything else that's going on. So.
But this is it. I've heard exactly the same sort of theories, and whilst I don't discount them, again, we have to go back to the evidence and see what we can come up with. And when we don't have a lot to go on, as I say, the domain of 28,000 feet in the air is one which is inaccessible to you and me. All we can do is look up, use, you know, high-powered zoom cameras to take pictures, ask questions of the Civil Aviation Authority, as I have done, and other people that I know have done this, ask questions of the Department of Transport and the airlines, and that's basically all we can do. We can't go up in a plane to that sort of altitude without filing a flight plan. If we were, say, let's go and sample a chemtrail, well, okay, let's hire a plane. How do we know which days we're going to see the trails? We may go up, hire a plane at, you know, whatever it is, £10,000 a day, fly around. Can we get a sample? No, there's no. It's all a clear sky today. We haven't seen any trails. So you're right. How do we get the evidence? So I think this is why I took the air traffic route as one possible avenue of exploration. I invested this money in this equipment to try and get some type of scientific evidence which we can measure, because science is all about measurement. I haven't published any. I haven't got a PhD or a master's degree, but I have published various articles in which I've put evidence together and tried to come to a conclusion. And my work in software engineering involves, you know, looking at a problem, developing evidence to, find out what the problem is, writing your program, which is deterministic. Does it work? You look at the evidence, you have a set of test data that you work through. Does it match the specification? So this is a scientific process. And so this is what you have to apply if you want to, be accepted by sort of more mainstream scientists.
I think one thing is for definite, though, whatever is in those chemtrails is certainly not going up into the atmosphere. The chances are it's probably dropping down in terms, when you mentioned aluminium, barium, they're quite heavy, heavy metals, so they're certainly coming down towards the this direction as opposed to in the opposite direction.
Well, I think that, again, it's difficult to say exactly what form it would be in, if it's particulate. I've heard people have had water samples tested and things like this, but it needs to be tied up with actual, photographs and videos of the chemtrail activity. I've got some time-lapse webcams that I've been doing this with now, this sort of thing, and that, I think, needs a bit more development to prove it up. But certainly, as you said, if they are putting these substances in, then it could be affecting the immune system. And I think, as Neil said, geoengineering, that's the other thing that's been on the table. We had a big conference on geoengineering in San Francisco in February. We've had a UK government paper on geoengineering regulations, which
I've
was published
it.
In...
I've got it on screen right now, actually. It's the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology, it's from March 2009, and it's geoengineering research. Just briefly, I'll just read the start of it, the introduction. It says, there is evidence that efforts to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases may be insufficient to avert unacceptable levels of climate change. Global emission levels are currently higher than even the highest scenario produced by the IPCC. Geoengineering seeks to use global scale engineering to offset the effects of greenhouse gas emissions. So we know that geoengineering and the whole global warming thing is quite closely linked, and this could be an explanation of what is going on and how it's going on, and why they're doing what they're doing, or why they claim
they're doing what they're doing,
which is totally different thing.
Well, absolutely, and I think, I think there is something in this idea of what's called predictive programming, which again is psychology. If you start to put these things out in the media now and, put them into people's minds and say that, oh, we're, you know, global warming is so bad, we need to now do geoengineering, and you're actually already doing it, then people are not going to have a chance to argue with it. They're just going to accept it. They're probably not going to argue with it, and they're just going to accept it. And I think this is what's happening. And people, again, going back to 9/11, people are not aware of the evidence of geoengineering that was done on 9/11. This is one thing, you know, that Neil, for example, didn't bring up, the presence of Hurricane Erin, which was 500 miles off the coast of New York, closest to New York, 8 a.m. in the morning on 9/11, next day, made a right-hand turn and went off the coast up towards Newfoundland. And you can go onto Dr. Judy Wood's website and you can look at all the weather data there, look at all the anomalies, and I certainly can't dismiss that as a coincidence. And this is not a theory. The hurricane really was there. You can go and check in all the national hurricane databases. It really did make a right-hand turn. It really did go past Bermuda on the 7th of September and then more or less go in a straight line towards New York. So the only alternative you have is you have to dismiss it as a coincidence. And I think once you start to do that, then to me, what you're saying is not believable, is not credible. And for those that do not want to embrace this data and look at how it ties in with the field effects, which were part of the weapon which was used to destroy the World Trade Center, which was, again, that evidence was submitted to court. It's not a theory. So, you know, people need to look at these things. Karen Douglas needs to look at these things if she wants to look at the future of our planet. All the listeners need to look at these in more detail and look at all these things thoroughly. Spend as much time as they can because it's going to hopefully at the end of it change the world that we live in.
All right, Andrew Johnson, we're almost out of time. Very quickly, I just want to ask you about the Wake Up Call 3 conference coming up. It's advertised on your website in Edinburgh with Jim Corr. It's on Saturday, 20th of November of this year. Is that something you're going to or participating in?
I'm not participating in the conference. I was in last year's in November. I may go up, not sure, because I've got, you know, things that I've got responsibilities here to look after. I may try and go up if I can. But yes, it looks like an interesting event. Lloyd Pye is another speaker to look out for there. Very interesting that he's got, again, evidence of the Star Child skull. That's a really good one to look out for. And again, Jim Corr, again, he's obviously quite a high-profile speaker in terms of his background and everything. So, yeah, it should be an interesting one.
Okay. Andrew Johnson, thank you very much for joining us tonight, and we will speak to you again in the future.
Absolutely. Anytime, Tony. Thanks for inviting me.
No problem. Thank you very much.